This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
He did it. He got away with it. And there's nothing we can do.
It's been quite a week with outrage over upskirting after the state's highest court rules that taking photos up women's skirts in public is legal. And organizers of South Boston's St. Patrick's Day parade say gays will not be allowed to march openly in the event, even though some residents say move on.
I think if asked individually, a lot of people would say, you'd find more people saying, no, I don't care, you know, let them march.
And Boston Mayor Marty Walsh still hopes to work out a deal.
I'm hoping that we're going to be all marching in the parade, and we're going to continue discussions for a few more days, and we'll report when we're all done with it.
And the state inspector general issues a powerful report detailing failures that led to the Hinton Drug Lab scandal.
The lack of effective management and oversight provided the atmosphere for someone like Annie Ducan to commit her crimes.
So, much to discuss in our Week in Review. Let's dive right in with Peter Kanellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hi there, Peter.
Hi, Meghna.
It's great to have you, Peter. Also here with us in the studio is David Scharfenberg, WBUR's political reporter. Hello, David.
Hello there.
Happy Friday to both of you, gentlemen. So let's start with the intense controversy over the SJC's upskirting ruling. The court said, yes, it's legal under current Massachusetts statutes. So yesterday, the legislature changed the law, passing a bill that outlaws upskirting, or the taking of photos up a woman's skirt. We've got some tape here from Senate President Therese Murray, who vowed to rewrite the law right after the SJC issued its ruling.
The first reaction was, what? Of course it's illegal to put your hand under a woman's skirt and take a picture, but the court doesn't believe it is against the law. So that just makes no sense to me. To me, it's sexual harassment and should be covered under some part of the statute. But if it isn't, we are moving very quickly. My office and the speaker's office, we're putting together some language that will cover this.
And they did just that. And it took only a few hours for lawmakers to pass a law outlawing the practice. And Governor Patrick signed that bill this morning. So, Peter, let me start with you. If I remember correctly, you had law school sometime in your past.
Yes.
What do you make of the SJC's ruling and the speed with which the legislature acted?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom is that they sort of have a point that the issue is whether it counts as being partially clothed if you're taking a picture up someone's skirt. Personally, I think they could have said, look, you know, obviously people are wearing skirts for a reason, and if you're aiming a camera up it, you're aiming at something that's improperly clothed. But they, be it as it may, the SJC decided to follow the letter of the law and say that this was not illegal. It obviously exposed a lack of updating of criminal statutes that we're all very glad that the legislature and Governor Patrick have fixed.
Mm. And David, on that point, is this a case where, you know, it seems like one of an increasing number of cases where it seems as if technology is outpacing the law, and the law through the courts and the legislature scrambling to catch up?
That's right. The criminal voyeurism law here in Massachusetts was written sometime before cell phone cameras became so ubiquitous, so it was a bit out of date in that sense. And while this is a bit of a almost amusing anomaly in some ways, I think it also does speak to some larger issues here. We have big questions throughout our country about the rapidly shifting technology and how it's not keeping up with our kind of evolving notions of privacy. And so in a way, I think it speaks to that broader dilemma we're seeing all over the place.
Right. And this story had, or this issue had, both the serious ramifications and kind of the click frenzy viral nature to it, because it basically, it's news that went around the world through the internet, and even Stephen Colbert on his show took a couple shots at the state of Massachusetts. I see that one official told the Boston Herald that it's the most embarrassing thing to happen in Massachusetts since Bill Buckner let the ball bounce between his legs and the ball took a cell phone pic on the way through. So a little light moment there on a serious issue. But Peter, I'm wondering what you make of the fact that the legislature did act with such speed. I mean, lightning speed practically. And so many other bills seem to languish at the state house.
It's absolutely true. No, we hear all the time that, you know, we can't take up education reform because it's going to take too long and things. I mean, there's a little bit of understanding to that. Obviously, on some complicated matters, they want to make sure that everybody is heard and that all the members have a chance to weigh in. Whereas when there's, you know, overwhelming agreement, as there was in this case, they can move much more quickly. But it does make you think that, you know, where there's a will, there's a way, and that they can speed things along if the leadership had a little more courage sometimes.
Uh-huh. David, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree largely with what Peter said. I mean, I think, again, complicated legislation does take time. But, you know, part of this is the spotlight, too, right? I mean, it's getting all kinds of attention here and all around the country that tends to spur legislators to action. So I'm not too surprised.
Right. This isn't necessarily a transportation omnibus bill. It's a
not exactly,
simple, straightforward one. And they did indeed act. All right. Well, let's move on to another issue that made a lot of headlines this week. And that has to do with ongoing tensions regarding South Boston's St. Patrick's Day parade. The inclusion of openly gay groups in the parade has been fought over for years now, and this week both sides met to try to hammer out a deal. On Radio Boston on Monday, we spoke with Kara Cordini, who's executive director of Mass Equality.
Parade organizers and Mass Equality sat down together for the first time in a face-to-face conversation. It's a really historic moment in this ongoing dialogue that has happened about this parade over the last 20 years. I think that in and of itself is a step forward. We all know that change always starts with a conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's great that we've been able to come together face-to-face and start to have a conversation about what the LGBT community marching in the parade would look like.
So, David, these discussions are still ongoing, but take us through the progress, if any, that was made this week.
There's been tons of back and forth. It seems to change every day. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they're negotiating this thing on the floats, you know, come St. Patrick's Day. It just keeps changing. But the latest we know is Marty Walsh saying, despite some recent setbacks, that he's still hopeful a deal can be reached. So we'll all be keeping an eye on it.
Okay, so we're going to come back to the issue, how this issue affects Mayor Walsh. But, Peter, I want to ask you about how residents of South Boston are reacting to this, because they do remain divided over the inclusion of gay groups in the parade. We've got some tape here of resident Gertie Chapin this week, who compared the controversy over gay groups marching in the South Boston St. Patrick's Day parade to another historical flashpoint in South Boston.
I think if asked individually, a lot of people would say, you'd find more people saying, no, I don't care, you know, let them march. But you get one little rabble rouser and then everyone jumps on the bandwagon, just like the busing was. You know, so many people didn't even know why they were mad.
Peter, do you think that's an accurate assessment, that so many people, or at least some people in the community, as Gertie says, don't even know why they're mad?
Well, you know, South Boston has its own psychology, and there's a sense that it's a very insular, very conservative community that is distrustful of outsiders moving in. But this has been going on for a very, very long time. Maybe 20 years ago, when this controversy first really caught fire, you could say that there was something provocative about having a gay group in the parade. But this is an Allied war veterans parade. The military itself has come to grips with the reality of homosexuality in the ranks. You know, it just makes South Boston look so bad to be excluding this group. And the rest of society, particularly in Massachusetts, has moved on, made progress, you know, kept on moving forward. It's really time for South Boston residents to tell the parade organizers, who are themselves largely elderly, it's really time to let Mass Equality march.
Yeah, I take your point. But on the other hand, many residents in the community do have some very deeply held feelings about this. We've got a little bit more tape from someone named Mariana Kadrival from the Immaculate Heart of Mary School. And the school says it's not going to participate if gays are indeed allowed to march.
Our Catholic faith comes first, and we have to stand by our principles, even if it means that we might have to sacrifice being in the parade.
So what about that argument?
Yeah, well,
David?
This is an issue where we have the Pope himself this week saying that he could imagine the church supporting civil unions under some situations. And you also have the Pope himself saying, who am I to judge when dealing with gay people? So I don't know where these people are referring to here, but it seems like the Catholic Church itself is moving on more than some of these parade organizers.
Yeah, and it seems if you're going to stick to Catholic doctrine completely, then divorced people shouldn't be allowed to march in the parade either, but they are. But David, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little question here that these groups have a right not to participate if you're that Immaculate Heart of Mary school, and the parade organizers even have the legal right to exclude gay groups if they want to, but it's just interesting to me how the symbolism has changed around this. I mean, a decade ago, this was a symbol of the uphill fight that gays faced, and now it just seems like this anomaly, really out of sync with what's happening locally and around the country.
So let's talk for a minute about how this all reflects on Mayor Marty Walsh, because, you know, as we recall it, when he ran for mayor, he ran under a very inclusive campaign, and, you know, this is a neighborhood that he's obviously very familiar with. You know, what impact would it have had, if he can't actually, like, broker some kind of deal about a parade?
Yeah, you know, Marty Walsh is a really interesting figure in this, I think. I mean, he's a son of Irish immigrants. He grew up not far from South Boston, knows it well, as you said. As late as last year, he was marching in the parade as a state legislator. But he ran on this platform of kind of serving as a bridge between an older Boston and a newer Boston. And this is really the first opportunity to be that bridge, to kind of unite an older Boston and a newer Boston. And he's invested a significant amount of political capital in this. He's in the papers every day trying to do this. And so I think if it doesn't happen, it will be a bit of a chink in the armor. All that said, I think, you know, he's going to get credit here for trying to broker a deal. I mean, this is where the majority of the city wants things to go, and they'll see him as someone who made a good faith effort in the end.
Peter, is that good enough, the good faith effort, or, you know, will it reflect badly on Marty Walsh if he can't actually get, as David said, old Boston and new Boston to, you know, to align?
No, I think that his effort has been quite strong in this area, and it's clear that he's used some political capital here, and it's actually been quite good to see him sort of functioning in a very confident way so early in his term. On this issue, there have been some other issues where he's sort of feeling his way through still.
Okay. Well, there's another major news story that we definitely should touch on, and that is the report about the state drug lab scandal. Everyone will recall that former chemist Annie Ducan mishandled evidence and falsified test results on drugs that were seized by the police, compromising more than 40,000 samples and leading to the release of hundreds of inmates. Well, Inspector General Glenn Cunha's new report this week said that Ducan was the sole bad actor, but also that more broadly, bad management is to blame. For example, Cunha said that the Hinton lab did not use proper procedures to do things like weigh drug samples in drug trafficking cases, and sometimes potentially exculpatory evidence was not reported. Let's listen.
The lab only reported the final results to the prosecutors, thereby failing to provide potentially exculpatory evidence. We've initiated retests of approximately 2,300 samples in order to confirm the accuracy of the drug lab's findings.
So, Peter, you know, Cunha calling Ducan the sole bad actor, but definitely also laying blame at the foot of an entire system behind here. What's your thoughts on the report?
It was quite damaging. I think that when you're talking about putting people in prison for crimes and the persuasiveness of this scientific evidence, it really has to be unimpeachable. And the idea that people weren't being properly trained and that there weren't known procedures, and obviously somebody like Annie Ducan can come in and, you know, basically bluff her way through, it reflects terribly on the criminal justice system, and it's going to result in thousands of cases being overturned, and it should, but it's clearly a total debacle for the criminal justice system.
David, your first thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to wait and see how this plays out. I mean, the one way in which the system has looked good, I think, is in its sort of careful combing through of the wreckage of this scandal, but still a ways to go.
Okay. So there's a little bit more to dig in here, because this week also the Supreme Judicial Court on this issue ruled that some defendants cannot withdraw the guilty pleas they've made. But on the other hand, in the wake of the Inspector General's report, defense attorneys in those cases still call for dramatic action. We've got some tape here from Anthony Benedetti, chief counsel at the Committee for Public Counsel Services. He said earlier this week that the cases of maybe 26,000 individuals affected by Ducan's tampering should be immediately dismissed.
A closer analysis should be used to look at every test that came out of that lab. I mean, when you look at what the inspector general found with the hiring, the training, the oversight, inadequate protocols, it's just simply plenty of evidence here to call into question everything that came out of that lab.
So, Peter, I want to throw a very big question to you, but I know you can handle it. What about, I mean, is there any likelihood of, you know, the courts vacating some, if not all, of these cases?
I think there is a likelihood of it. And I mean, these are all drug cases. So thankfully, some of them are not violent crimes. But I mean, there's a, you know, a basic question of fairness here. And that is, if somebody made a plea bargain because they were told that there was scientific evidence showing that there were drugs in their system or drugs on their possession or whatever, you know, I could imagine situations in which innocent people would say, my God, the system's rigged against me. I'll accept this, you know, plea of probation or plea of 100 days to avoid going through trial, and these people have permanent records that affect their lives forever. I mean, it's something that has to be dealt with.
Mm. David, significant changes have been made in how evidence is handled at drug labs. Specifically, now the state police drug lab has sort of taken over a lot of this. Do we think that adequate reforms sort of have been made across the system to assure that a catastrophic failure like this doesn't happen again?
Again, to be seen here. You know, one thing I think is interesting is just, you know, the fallout for the governor from all of this. You know, we did a poll back in January asking voters what they thought about this and other issues. And we found that he was a bit of a Teflon governor. I mean, people thought that that he wasn't really to blame. He couldn't have his fingers in every pie here around the state. But, you know, longer term, if he does run for president someday, he's kind of shrugged it off a bit, but hasn't closed the door completely. You know, all this stuff could get a more thorough vetting before a national audience. And so we'll see long term how his legacy holds up around this stuff.
Well, Peter, let me ask you about that, because the governor was front and center this week when the inspector general did release his report. And he was going over, the governor was going over exactly some of the changes that have been made in the wake of the drug lab scandal. I mean, what's your assessment on the effect that this may have on Patrick?
Well, I think Governor Patrick has been an effective troubleshooter when these things have come up. There have just been too many problems under his tenure. You know, things not working. When you think back to things like the compounding pharmacies that that occurred, and some of the controversy now over the marijuana sites, the dispensaries being there's a long list of managerial problems within the state. So I think that at a certain point, while Patrick has been very good at dealing with these things individually, the overall, you know, sheer number of cases reflects poorly on him. I think it also will have an effect on the race to replace him, in that, you know, managerial competence will be proportionally, you know, more important in this race than in some of the previous governor's races.
Interesting. So that governor's race, you know, continuing to unfold as every month passes by, it'll get hotter and hotter, I'm sure. But we've got just enough time, gentlemen, for our hubbubs this week. And David, may I start with you?
I'm going to start with Birdie, the pet parakeet. This was a parakeet in Milton this week who wandered into a pipe, a dark place where she wanted to lay her egg. It turned out to be the pipe for a shop vac.
Oh, no.
Her owner sucked her up into a ball of feathers, but luckily an hour-long surgery, which did involve the amputation of 25% of her wing, saved Birdie. She is back home to roost, I'm happy to report.
Okay, so a good news story, even though a poor choice of nesting location.
Yes,
for poor Birdie. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. Peter, do you have something slightly more uplifting for us?
Yeah, not necessarily, but it can be. Dan Rivera, the new mayor of Lawrence, is taking over a long, trouble-plagued city hall. Most recently, his predecessor, William Lantigua, was under federal investigation for a long time. Part of turning the page, Rivera says, is asking that all the men in the office wear ties and all the women dress in, you know, dress up in more appropriate ways to convey a sense of seriousness in dealing with the people's business at City Hall. Now, I must say, if I were an employee, I might resent being told there was a dress code, but I also think that it's within the discretion of Mayor Rivera, and I think it's an admirable impulse to want to, like, have some sort of a physical demonstration of a new seriousness at City Hall in Lawrence.
Injecting, you know, at least the perception of professionalism is the first step to achieving greater professionalism, perhaps.
I agree. Yeah, there it is.
So so even though we don't see you right now because you're at the Globe's ISDN over there on Morrissey Boulevard, I trust that even though it's Friday, you're wearing a suit and tie, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah, no question.
I'm in my my Radio Boston power suit, which includes a polar fleece and jeans. So, all right, gentlemen, my hubbub today actually has to do with what I think is a great story, even though it has to do with the sad illness of a young boy. And that young boy is Louis Corbett. He's 12 years old. He's from New Zealand, and he's rapidly, because of a medical condition, he's losing his sight. He's going blind. And before he fully loses his sight, his parents decided they wanted to take him on a worldwide tour of the, you know, the world's most beautiful places to see and exciting things that he wanted to visit. He wanted to see things in the United States like the Grand Canyon and Google headquarters. But it turns out also that this young New Zealander is obsessed with American basketball and is a huge Boston Celtics fan. So an extraordinary number of coincidences and good Samaritans and people with really huge hearts, including Corinne Grousbeck, whose husband just happens to be one of the owners of the Celtics. They all got together and brought Louis Corbett and his family to the Garden to see a Celtics game. And the story gets even better because it just so happens that Corinne Grousbeck, one of her son, 21-year-old Campbell, was also blinded by a similar condition. And that day that Louis saw the game at the Garden, students from the Perkins School of Blind sang the national anthem. So a bunch of people getting together help a young kid have some lasting visual memories of a game at Boston Garden. I just thought that was terrific. So that's my hubbub for the day. And as always, David Scharfenberg, political reporter for WBUR. Great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, which, is, by the way, is launching a new and expanded opinion section this weekend. We'll keep an eye out on it. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
There's more of the show in just a moment. This is Radio Boston.